Hello, it's May 1st, 2019. It's a Sunday afternoon with some clouds and stuff. But yeah, this isn't really a weather forecast. This podcast episode is quite political, actually. And it revolves around precisely the question of how significant is money in the pursuit of a challenger defeating an incumbent in the U.S. election. So this U.S. election may be as big as a presidential election, however it may be as small as some state government, some state legislature seat. And we all know about the notorious incumbency advantage, so this will discuss the financial aspects of that and how a challenger is kind of put in a disadvantage and how they can overcome that with money, precisely. And so a little bit about me. My name is Tariq Mohammed Zain. I'm currently enrolled in Deep Run High School in Henrico County in Richmond, Virginia. I'm planning to attend Georgia Institute of Technology in the fall. But yeah, that's it. That's really enough about me. Let's get into the juicy contents of this podcast. Part 1, the incumbency advantage. So, we know more or less the gist of the concept, but not what actually makes up the advantage. First, it is obvious that incumbents enjoy a financial edge over the challengers. In fact, elected officials often spend a great deal of their time in office raising money for their campaigns in the next election rather than doing actual office work. Challengers could do the same thing in their daily lives, and they do, but this leads us to the next advantage, name recognition. Sure, challengers could raise money for the longest time, but incumbents are known better, so they have an easier time getting contributions from more individuals and political action committees. Similar to this is the institutional support, franking advantage, and others. However, it isn't always rainbows and butterflies. The incumbency advantage is no way a good thing. How's incumbents stay in office for, say, 3 elections on average, so 6 years, and Senate incumbents for 2 elections, so, well, say, 12 years. So, in essence, we would have the same legislature for the same term as a senator. This cycle continues, and before you know it, we have the House acting just as elite as the Senate. Often, candidates are so aware of the incumbency advantages that they don't even challenge incumbents. It truly demotivates them. Still, challengers actually have an advantage over incumbents. And I took the time to interview my AP government teacher, Mr. Bushka, and one segment of the interview actually works to clarify my point. So here it is. We know that incumbents have several advantages over challengers. However, is there any specific advantage that challengers have over their incumbents that they should know about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say if they can get some like momentum going and coverage in the media, a lot of it is based on like name recognition and kind of like the public's perception of you. So, like, Joe Biden is running for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. But he has a lot of name recognition, and he has kind of like a built-in brand. So that kind of automatically puts him as a front runner. He was polling as the number one candidate before he even, declared his candidacy. So if you have some kind of hook or thing, or like people know who you are from something else, and Donald Trump like used the same type of thing because he was already a celebrity before he became a politician. So that can always be helpful. In terms of like the relationship between like challenger to incumbent, the challenger having an advantage. They don't have any political baggage maybe. If they're new to politics, they can kind of say like I'm a fresh voice and I haven't done anything bad. I don't have any like negative votes or like laws or whatever policies that they can pass. So I think that's probably their primary advantage. Is just it's something different.
So to combat the advantage which incumbents naturally have, challengers should aim to become more relevant and recognized in the eyes of the public. Additionally, the sheer fact that challengers have not been in office is an advantage in itself. They don't have, as Mr. Bushka said, political baggage. In this case, they can look to dig up dirt on the incumbent and use that to show how they would be better in office. campaign finance laws. Campaign finance laws are laws established by Congress in a pursuit to regulate the use of money in political campaigns. Through this establishment, the Supreme Court of the United States faced a dilemma of advocating the First Amendment or controlling the possible corruption within campaigns. The more significant money becomes in influencing politics, the more the government is thriving to impose regulations on how much and in what way money is being used. For instance, in Buckley v. Vallejo in 1976, the Supreme Court ruled that governmental restrictions on individual contributions to political campaigns did not violate the First Amendment. Even the reading of the Constitution changes when money gets involved. Citizens United v. the FEC in 2010 led to the controversial statement that corporations have the right of the freedom of speech, as does a regular citizen in terms of independent political broadcasts. In the campaign finance world, there are two types of money: hard money and soft money. I spoke to Mr. Bushka about these two types of money, and he was able to explain the difference between them pretty well.
Hard money is money that is limited and disclosed. So we know where the money came from and we know where it went. Soft money is unlimited, and there are maybe like less requirements on where the money can come from. So hard money is like the most regulated type of campaign donation, and soft money is less, there's less restrictions on it.
So the question arises, how well do these laws work to actually limit contributions?
In 2002, McCain-Feingold was created, the law was passed to limit soft money contributions, and Citizens United in 2010 overturned that. So I would say, like, right now, there aren't really very many restrictions on soft money donations from groups. They can spend unlimited amounts of money, like super PACs and stuff. They just aren't supposed to coordinate directly with the candidate. But you can, you don't have to necessarily coordinate directly with the candidate to impact the, you know, the results of the election, because a lot of it is, you know, name recognition is important. So just like getting someone's name out there, running ads. So you don't have to be the campaign to run ads that support a particular candidate. So I would say, like, the way the laws are right now, this is kind of like a golden age of like being able to spend as much as you want with like very little restrictions if you are some like outside group or lobbying group or something like that.
Like Mr. Bushka put it, this is a golden age for raising money. No one is stopping anyone from raising a boatload of money, especially a challenger who is largely irrelevant compared to the incumbent. So the first thing a challenger should do is make sure they have several PACs and wealthy individuals behind them, because they sure will come in handy. Part 3, the wrap-up. So we've gone through the company's advantage and the fundamentals of campaign finance laws, but we still haven't quite answered the question of how significant is money for a challenger to be an incumbent. In short, money is pretty significant. If a challenger tries to tell you otherwise, they're probably lying. Take the 7th District of Virginia, for example. Congressman Dave Brown was the incumbent, Abigail Spanberger was a challenger. I met with Spanberger during a community event after she won the election, and I asked her straightforward, how did you beat Brett? Was it the money? And she said, it wasn't really the money that won me my election. It was rather my ability to relate to the people of the district and to meet with minority groups consistently. I asked Mr. Bushko what he thought about that statement, but before he listens to that, let me give a little stats. Abigail Spanberger spent more than $7.2 million on her campaign. Dave Brat spent a mere $3.3 million. Spanberger spent more than double what Dave Brat spent on the campaign. Just keep that in mind. So how much do you agree with the statement, or how much do you feel like there's some kind of falsehood within that?
Well, so I haven't looked at her specific like funding, so I guess I can't really like speak to that specifically. But I would say, like, within the context of the larger like 2018 midterm elections, there are a lot of women that are elected into office, and there are, you know, the Democrats take the House. So there's kind of this, at least in the House, there's this blue wave. And that's, you know, that's helpful in unseating an incumbent is, kind of being of the, you know, the opposition party, and you can kind of ride the coattails of like belonging to part of that group. I guess another thing with the 7th District in particular, it is different in terms of what it encompasses than it was in 2014 when Dave Brat won the district. There were some changes due to some court decisions on gerrymandering for the 3rd District. So that could also be a factor. Henrico specifically, which is, you know, the bulk of the population of the 7th District is in Henrico County because most of the other counties are rural, is also changing demographically. And it's much different than it was even 10 years ago. So that's, you know, that's also a factor when we look at like voting patterns in terms of like demographics and like which groups of people vote for which parties and policies and stuff like that.
So in conclusion, money is significant, but isn't as significant as it may seem. Many other factors contribute to a challenger's ability to beat an incumbent. Thus, I decided to make a list of what challengers should make sure to do for their campaign. 1. Have a good reputation prior to running. 2. Make your name more known to the public. 3. Watch the way in which the demographics of your district are changing. 4. Meet with minority groups of those changing demographics. 5. Get young volunteers for your campaign. 6. Hire opposition staff to dig up dirt on the incumbent you'll be facing. And last, get some money.